Okay, let us begin. I am David Wee. I am a retired college English professor and enjoying retirement, which allows these kind of things to happen. I've been doing a series, and some of you have been at the other ones already, so you don't need to be told this, but each session is entitled An Hour with the Poets. On Monday, we did the poetry of Billy Collins, who is a U.S. poet laureate. And yesterday, we did the poetry of cancer patients and their families and their caregivers. This one is different. This is going to be introducing you to a project and a book. And I've got the title and the editors up here. It's Americans' Favorite Poems. And I noticed that the apostrophe is after the S. Right? It's the favorite poems of Americans. And what Robert Pinsky did as a special project when he was poet laureate was create a website and use other means as well to invite anyone in America to let them know what is their favorite poet and why. Why is this one particularly significant to you? They got 17,000 people replying, sending in, this is my favorite poem, and here is why it's my favorite. And I'll be reading some of those tonight, and reading some of the statements that the people sent in along with their favorite poem. And fascinating to me to get reinforced by the fact that poetry really matters to lots of people in this country, as you'll be able to tell by some of the statements. None of these people who sent their favorite poem, or very few of them at least, are poets. None of them are famous people, famous writers. But any of us can have a favorite poem. And some of them tell a little story that explains it. So I will read these. And if we have time at the end, and if during the hour you are reminded of a poem, or want to share with the rest of us what your favorite poem is, why, that would be fun to hear. Not all of us have a favorite poem or a favorite novel, but some are very meaningful to us, so that would be fun to hear from anybody. And if the poem I'm about to read is your favorite poem or one of your favorite poems, wave your hand and you may read it. Because that would be really fun for you to do. And that may not happen in this group tonight, but if we had 200 people in the audience, I'm sure that some of those that I picked, not exactly at random, I've kept mostly poems that are only a page long or less, and ones that I happen to like as well. So, here we go. You know, we often, our image of the poet laureate usually dates back to England, where the king would appoint a kind of personal poet for the royalty. And the only job sometimes of that poet laureate was to write a poem to celebrate the king's birthday or the queen's or some other national event, and that was about it. Otherwise, you just had tea with the king a couple times a year, and he paid your rent. So, in our country, you know, recently, as we've tried to improve on that model, we've asked the poets laureate, who usually serve for just a couple of years. In England, they'd serve for life, and Wordsworth would be poet laureate for 30 years, and finally he would die, and then Tennyson became that kind of thing. Now it's more limited, so it wasn't a lifetime thing. And our poets laureate have had wonderful ideas. This is one of them that we'll hear tonight. Let's ask all Americans to say, here's my favorite poem, and here's a few words about why it's meaningful to me. And we read the poems of Billy Collins on Monday, who was the poet laureate that came right after Robert Pinsky. And Billy Collins had a terrific idea, which was to get the schools of America, which generally have 180 school days in the academic year, to begin each day with a poem. And he published a book called 180. Picked 180 poems that he thought were good poems, reasonably brief, and that would speak to the young people of our country. Now, I don't know how many schools actually followed through on that, and, you know, over the loudspeaker during the morning announcements, you know, had the poem read every day for 180 days, but it's a great idea. And this is another terrific idea.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
How's the poet laureate chosen?
Rebecca, you probably know better than I.
It's a committee of folks at the Library of Congress that vote, and I don't know, I'm not sure who they contact or if they just do it themselves,
okay.
But there's a committee that makes a decision based on a poet's contributions to the...
Okay.
To the
And that committee is, the Library of Congress is a legislative creation of our national government. Yes.
How long have the U.S. had a poet laureate?
Well, somebody else might know the answer to that. We've only called this person poet laureate for, I think, about 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And it used to be, the title was consultant to the Library of Congress, which was really a bad title for somebody to honor as the leading poet of the nation, or a representative of the best poet. So it's, I can't tell you the exact first year that they first did that. Okay, and I'm taking these, in this book, the poems are all in alphabetical order according to the author's last name. So I'm going to start with one by Matthew Arnold. When I taught Victorian literature for many years, and at the end of the term, after reading Tennyson and Browning and Thomas Hardy and so forth, I'd ask my students, who is your favorite poet? And everyone we read this semester, almost always it was Matthew Arnold, who the person on the street probably had never heard of. And Matthew Arnold, oddly, spent his life as an accreditor of schools. He was a school inspector and went around and was the academic narc to make sure that schools were meeting the standards. But he was a brilliant poet at the same time. This one is called Dover Beach. It's about a page long. One writer who sent in this poem, and as you can imagine, any one poem was recommended by maybe 100 people or 50 people, many at least out of those 17,000 who nominated poems. This person said, "The poem itself speaks the tragedy that tears at the gut of any thinking person." And another one says, "The soothing cadence of this poem was a comfort to me long before I even understood the scope of the idea it offers. As a teen, I imagined the intimate setting shared by lovers as one draws the other to the window and speaks of the sea and the moon, clouds and eternity." And then the final stanza pleads for the security I hope will prevail amidst life's confusing mixture of hope and dread. Throughout my adult life, I have returned to this piece as a reminder that the strength I need comes from a loving relationship. And the third person said, "The sound of the sea is in it. It makes me sigh and hope." So here's Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. "The sea is calm tonight, The tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window, sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return. Up the high strand, begin and cease and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean. And it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. It's a kind of a dismal scene. The sound of the sea and the sea retreating brings a sense of calmness and then mourning and almost despair to the speaker here. Here's one by Rupert Brooke, called The Soldier. Rupert Brooke wrote this during World War I, 1914. But this reader, a nurse from Rooker, Florida, said, "I'm an immigrant. I have been in the USA for 22 years, and after all this time, I'm still homesick for England. And believe me, I'm not alone. Being an immigrant is not a one-time decision. It is a decision remade every day of one's life, my life. My husband is American, but all my blood family is 3,500 miles away, growing up, marrying, having children, dying. The homesickness never goes away. Yet I remain here, an American citizen, and I will die here," which brings me to Rupert Brooke's poem. Little did I know, when I fell in love with the poem in school, that the same fate would befall me, that I would be destined to one day enrich a corner of a foreign field. The soldier sums up my feelings perfectly. I will never go home again. I'm not sure where home is anymore. Now that's longer than the poem, which is just astounding for 15 lines. But you get the sense of some of us when we have a strong sense of place and we are displaced from that and our home becomes someplace else, there can be a pain about where you were brought up. And this is a soldier anticipating the possibility of death fighting war in a foreign land. If I should die, think only this of me, that there is some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by suns of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less give somewhere back the thoughts by England given. her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven. Sense that where our body lies after death will bring with it and give the very things that gave us life and nurture. Here's one by Willa Cather that I had never read until I got this book. This book, by the way, is available in our Holden bookstore. Three copies of it in there. If you find that you want more, here's the name. A woman named Patricia Curran, age 54, from Seattle, Washington, wrote this note in nominating this poem. I love this poem, not only because it speaks personally to my feelings about my own grandmother and my feelings at losing a lover, but because Willa Cather is one of our nation's greatest writers. Her words challenge us to think and to feel. That's what all great poetry must do. So here's the speaker is someone who lost her lover and is coming to speak to her grandmother at her grandmother's grave. And it's kind of an archaic, some of the language is archaic, so what I'm reading is what she wrote. Grandmother, think not I forget when I come back to town and wander the old ways again and tread them up and down. I never smell the clover bloom nor see the swallows pass without I mind how good ye were unto a little lass, that is to the speaker here when she was a girl. I never hear the winter rain a-pelting all night through without I think and mind me of how cold it falls on you. And if I come not often to your bed beneath the time, mayhap 'tis that I change with you and give my bed for thine, would like to sleep in thine. I never hear the summer winds among the roses blow without I wonder why it was ye loved the lassie so. That is why ye loved me as a young lass. Ye gave me cakes and lollipops and pretty toys a score. I never thought I should come back and ask you now for more. Grandmother, give me your still white hands that lie upon your breast, for mine do beat the dark all night and never find me rest. They grope among the shadows and they beat the cold black air. They go seeking in the darkness and they never find him there. And they never find him there. Grandmother, give me your sightless eyes that I may never see his own, the burning full of love that must not shine for me. Grandmother, give me your peaceful lips, white as the churchyard snow. For mine be red with burning thirst, and he must never know. Grandmother, give me your clay-stopped ears, that I may never hear my lad a-singing in the night when I am sick with fear. A-singing when the moonlight o'er the land is, where all the land is white. Oh God, I'll up and go to him a-singing in the night, a-calling in the night. Here's the last stanza. Grandmother, give me your clay-cold heart that has forgot to ache, for mine be fire within my breast, and yet it cannot break. It beats and throbs forever for the things that must not be, and can ye not let me creep in and rest a while with thee? A little lass, a feared dark, slept by ye years agone. Ah, she has found what night can hold twixt sunset and the dawn. So when I plant the rose and rue above your grave for ye, you'll know it's under rue and rose that I would like to be, that I would like to be. The forsaken lover, changed places with her dead grandmother. Then Emily Dickinson. Her poems are very short, as many of you know. And I'm going to read three of them here. Some of the comments are interesting. The first one is, I never saw a Moor. Sounds like you know this one. You can read it if you like.
I know it, but you can read it.
Oh.
I'm waiting for my favorite.
Okay. One citizen said in these words, it reminds me of my mother who lived a very close life, yet accurately knew the workings of the world and the hearts and minds of people she never met. And a 77-year-old person from Jackson, Mississippi wrote, the poem expresses simply and elegantly the essence of faith, religious and otherwise. Faith, trust, and everyday wisdom regarding our world and life. Here it is, just eight lines, eight short lines. I never saw a moor. I never saw the sea. Yet know I how the heather looks, and what a billow be. I never spoke with God, nor visited in heaven. Yet certain am I on the spot, as if the checks were given. The next one is A Little Madness in the Spring. And this is just six lines long. And the first person to send this in and write was an 11-year-old girl from Anchorage, Alaska. And she wrote, the poem seems to give off beautiful colors in every word. I'm only 11, but every word of this poem means a whole lot to me. I'd like to have that woman in my class. Here's the poem. This is not the six-line one. This is a little hard to follow the places where the people make the comments and which poem they're commenting on. They're commenting on hope is the thing with feathers. 12 lines. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. Hope is a thing with feathers. Here's a Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. Favorite, one that many of us know. And one of the comments here is from a person who writes, I'm one of eight children from a small town in Idaho. I graduated from high school, number two in my class, and so forth, and went all the strange places he went to from his place in Idaho. And all of these places I've been in the world would never have been possible had I not taken this road, which he explains at length. The road not taken. This makes us think, of course, of the Trail Junction. A couple miles up the path. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. We often don't know when we are And then here's another one that I love very much. It's by Thomas Hardy, a great British poet of the 19th century and well into the 20th century. And this one came, and I know some of you have to leave, some of you have done this one or even before if you must. This was proposed by a prisoner. And he wrote, he was a state prisoner in Norfolk Prison in Massachusetts. He wrote, "Since so many Americans are now in prison, I thought that we should be represented as poetry lovers in the project." Thomas Hardy is my favorite poet. Interestingly, this poem was written on the eve of the turn of the century in 1900. It is a beautiful use of words that describes a scene and a mood, a sad end, but a beginning as well. Probably the last poem written in the 19th century, December 31st, 1900. The Darkling Thrush. I leaned upon a coppice gate when frost was specter gray, and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled vine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. Just like Dover Beach, a very dismal scene. The land's sharp features seem to be the century's corpse outleaped, and his crypt, the cloudy canopy, the wind his death lament. The ancient pulse of germ and birth was shrunken hard and dry, and every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I. At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead, in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the growing gloom. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar or nigh around, that I could think there trembled through his happy goodnight air some blessed hope whereof he knew that I was unaware. Here's a poem by Robert Hayden, entitled Those Winter Sundays. And one of the nominees of this says, "Until I read Hayden's poem with its awful conclusion, I had not tried to understand my own father's severity, and I let go of my subterranean anger. I thank the poet for that." This is very short. Oh, and one other writer said, "Broke my heart and restored it," about this poem. This is about 15 lines long. Those winter Sundays. Sundays too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather made blank banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house. Speaking indifferently to him, who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely? Sad childhood, anger between father and child, but all of these tenderly, freely given, caring gestures on behalf of the family. Here's one by Seamus Heaney, Irish poet. And the little explanation is by a 22-year-old student from Vermilion, South Dakota. He's been at the University of South Dakota. Because this poem reminded him so much of his loss of his grandfather, which had happened a little bit earlier. Midterm break. I sat all morning in the college sick bay, counting bells, nailing classes to a close. At 2 o'clock, our neighbors drove me home. In the porch, I met my father crying. He had always taken funerals in his stride. And Big Jim Evans saying it was a hard blow. The baby cooed and laughed and rocked the pram when I came in, and I was embarrassed by old men standing up to shake my hand and tell me they were sorry for my trouble. Whispers informed strangers I was the eldest, away at school, as my mother held my hand in hers and coughed out angry, tearless sighs. At 10 o'clock, the ambulance arrived with the corpse, stanched and bandaged by the nurses. Next morning, I went up into the room. Snowdrops and candles soothed the bedside. I saw him for the first time in 6 weeks, paler now, wearing a poppy bruise on his left temple. He lay in the 4-foot box, as in his cot. No gaudy scars. The bumper knocked him clear. A 4-foot box, a foot for every year. His 4-year-old brother, killed by a car. Calls home from college. Here's one by Langston Hughes. Wonderful black American poet. And one reader from Augusta, Georgia said, I have always loved this poem, but it became really significant for me in 1976 when I began to work in the adult literacy program in my community. Many of the students came back to school against great odds. They fought the put-downs of their family members for being, quote, too stupid to complete school. They fought against poverty, poor self-esteem, welfare, and abuses of all kinds during their lives because they lacked an adequate education. And another writer from Jackson, Mississippi, a 19-year-old, says, to me, this poem is a determination poem. It's saying that regardless of what happens, or what gets in your way, you have to keep going to reach those goals. And this one is entitled Mother to Son. It's 20 short lines. Mother to Son by Langston Hughes. Well, son, and I'm sorry that I can't have the appropriate accent for the speaker of this poem. Well, son, I'll tell you. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it, and splinters, and boards torn up, and places with no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time I've been a-climbing on, and reaching landings, and turning corners, and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So boy, don't you turn back. Don't you sit down on the steps because you finds it's kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I's still going, honey, I's still climbing, and life for me ain't been no crystal stair. Beautiful little poem. Here's one that has meant a lot to our family for various reasons. It's by Jane Kenyon, and it's entitled Otherwise. Can you read this one out, Bob, for us?
Sure.
Why not?
It's a great one.
Yep. Why don't you come here so to make sure the microphone's figure this out.
Otherwise, I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birchwood. All morning I did the work I love. At noon I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls and planned another day, just like this day. But one day I know it will be otherwise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jane Kenyon died of leukemia, so that otherwise came to her too quickly. Here's a poem by A.A. Milne, the British poet that many of you grew up with. The note is written by a 37-year-old woman from Ann Arbor, Michigan. When I was very young, my mother would read the poems of A.A. Milne to me. One poem became my favorite, and I made her read it to me again and again. I memorized it, and I was probably driving her nuts. So at one point, she handed me the book and told me to read it myself. I don't remember how old I was, maybe 5, but I would hold the book up in front of me and pretend I was reading as I recited it over and over. Mm-hmm. One day, and I remember this clearly, I was sitting on my bed, quote, reading, and I realized the words I was saying were those on the page. Mm-hmm. From that moment, I started picking the words from my poem and finding them in other poems in the book. Mm-hmm. In other books, or anywhere there were printed words, I could read. And from that point on, I've never stopped. My mother died when I was 18, but the love of books I inherited from her is the greatest gift I ever received. It all started with a tiny little poem that I didn't even know the title of until I was nearly 30. The poem is called Happiness, and the happiness it's brought me is immeasurable. And here it is. I didn't really know that that was its title either, but you all know this poem, I think. John had great big waterproof boots on. John had a great big waterproof hat. John had a great big waterproof Macintosh. And that, said John, is that. First poem that changed that person's life. Here's one by Russian Alexander Pushkin. Who wrote in the 19th century, in the 1800s. And a 65-year-old person from San Jose, California, sends this poem in with the message, "Every woman dreams about such love." Now, as I've read this over and over again, and I don't know if in the Russian it's different, but I can't tell whether the speaker is male or female. And so it perhaps speaks to all of us in the same way. It's entitled, "I Love You," and it's just 8 lines long. I loved you, and perhaps I love you still. The flame, perhaps, is not extinguished. Yet it burns so quietly within my soul. No longer should you feel distressed by it. Silently and hopelessly, I loved you. At times too jealous and at times too shy. God grant you find another who will love you as tenderly and truthfully as I. Mm-hmm. the speaker is, you know, I was a shy young lad, as boy, so I can imagine that, you know, I don't know if the speaker actually, you know, dated and or married or anything of the listener, or the person who's being addressed, and then I'm sure it's male or female. So we don't know anything about the speaker here. Pushkin died, I think, at age 38, and I don't know enough about his love life to know whether he drew it from personal experience or from simply the wisdom of the poet. And perhaps I'll end with this one, and then we can see what things people might like to say about poems you really like. This is by James Wright, an American poet who died about 30 years ago. Three different people are quoted here with their words as they sent this in, as their choice. An 18-year-old student from Massachusetts writes, "The poem leaps at you, and something moves inside. Metamorphosis. It's not just a poem." Another writer, a 52-year-old person from New Jersey, says, "This is the poem that changed my life forever. Nothing compares to the excruciating beauty of this poem." And a 57-year-old teacher from Portland writes, "This poem transports. It reminds me of those deeply moving, surprising moments in life when the sheer joy of existence envelops me and I know that even I can evolve." It's a poem of about 20 lines. It's called "A Blessing" by James Wright. And it has changed the lives of people. And the thing that, well, I won't say that till later. "A Blessing." Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass. And the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom." Now, one of the things that's interesting about all of us is that we have different tastes, we have different life experiences. And some of us may read that poem and just toss it aside and say, "Well, that was interesting, but it's just some people seeing a couple of horses on a field as they drive by." Other people say, "This poem changed my life forever, and it's just electric." Well, that's just a selection of the poems in here that people have described as their favorites. Do you have, any of you have some poem? You don't have to recite it or anything.
Of course, I'm going to say something. Isn't there anything for Harry Oliver in there? Wild Geese?
Yeah. Rebecca can probably just about recite that.
Yes.
I don't think so, but let me check.
If there isn't, it's because a couple of guys put this book together.
Maybe.
And there is one Mary Oliver poem.
Oh, good.
And it's "The Summer Day."
Okay. Yeah, read it. Go ahead and read it.
Okay, I'll read this one. It's about 20 lines long. See if the person said anything really interesting. Now, an author of children's books, I grew up in Houston in the shadow of the oil refineries. Both of my grandfathers worked in the oil industry, one for Sinclair and one for Shell, a blue-collar environment for sure. However, my father was and still is a true fan of Kipling and Longfellow, and I know that when I write my own books, I hear those two rhymers in my head as I go. Most of my books are in fact rhymed, but my favorite poem is not rhymed at all. I have this poem taped on the wall beside my desk, and I read it every day, sometimes several times. I make copies of it for friends. I read it to people over the phone. Mostly, I ask myself the question Oliver, the poet, poses at the end of the poem. I don't have the answer. I don't think I need one. But the question itself challenges me to revel in the search. 44-year-old from Texas. The summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last? And too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Good question for us to tape up on our mirror for every morning. Yeah, thanks for suggesting Mary Oliver.
My daughter was asked to read that at a wedding a few years ago.
And this
is
one
that
here?
Very
oh, funny. Wonderful.
Yes, one.
Yeah, very good. Any other good ones? Yes.
Carl Sandburg. Is
okay.
He in there? He's got
a I'll
name.
See if there's a Carl Sandburg. Yes. Chicago is in here. Is that a favorite of yours?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay.
I'm sure that one's very good.
Is that called Chicago City of Shoulders?
Yeah, how to mature for the world. Any Chicagoans here? Okay, do you know this poem then, perhaps?
No.
No,
okay.
Go ahead.
Well, it's time then. Okay, this is a little longer, maybe 30, 35 lines. And the person who sent this in says, Sandburg has captured the rhythms of the streetlight's vacillation, the lurid, sordid essence, and the pride that essence generates of my hometown. Though we are no longer butcher, nor toolmaker, nor wheat stacker, nor freight handler to the nation, are we not still a tall, old slugger? And do our big shoulders not shake with the laughter of youth? So here it is, Chicago. Hog butcher for the world, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps, luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it is true, I have seen the gunman kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, On the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth, under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing. Laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation. Fascinating way to anthropomorphize the city in that way. Well, we got a few more minutes if there are a few more. Yeah.
I have my computer with me.
Oh, good, yeah.
Well, no, I taught a women's lit class this spring, and there's a poet that I recently discovered from the 19th century named Sarah Piaf, and I had not had any familiarity with her.
Okay.
But I really like her poetry because she writes a lot of, she's writing in the 1870s, and she writes a lot of dialogue poems.
Okay.
It's kind of like Robert Browning almost, the soliloquy
style.
Yeah,
yeah.
But, would it be okay if I read you guys one? I have two of her poems right here.
Okay. Yeah.
This is called the Palace Burner, and the reference is she's looking. The idea of the sun is that she's looking at newspapers with her sons, and they see a picture of a woman from the Paris Commune who helped burn the palaces during the time, and now she's going to be executed for her crimes. So, okay. So she's the woman speaking as the mother. She has been burning palaces. To see the sparks look pretty in the wind? Well, yes, and something more. But women brave as she leave much for cowards such as I to guess. But this is old, so old that everything is ashes here, the woman and the rest. 2 years are so long. You may bring some newer pictures. You like this one best? You wish you had lived in Paris then? You would have loved to burn a palace too, but they had guns in France and Christian men shot wicked little communists like you. You would have burned the palace just because you could not live in it yourself? Oh, why? Have I not taught you to respect the laws? You would have burned the palace. Would not I? I? Go to your play, would I indeed? I, does the boy not know my soul to be languid and worldly, with a dainty need for light and music? Yet he questions me. Can he have seen my soul more near than I? Ah, in the dusk and distance, sweet she seems, with lips to kiss away a baby's cry, hands fit for flowers and eyes for tears and dreams. Can he have seen my soul? And could she wear such utter life upon a dying face, such unappealing, beautiful, such garments, soon to be a shroud, with grace? Has she a charm so calm that it could breathe in damp, low places till some frightened hour, then start like a fair, subtle snake and wreathe a stinging poison with a shadowy pallor? Would I burn palaces? The child has seen in this fierce creature of the commune here, so bright with bitterness and so serene, a being finer than my soul, I fear.
Thank you.
Same
elegy, and then do we know where Duane and Lennon say it, elegies? Some powerful stuff in there.
Okay.
Those things like every angel is terrifying.
All right, I'll see if anyone has sent in a Rilke. One poem by Rilke, Entrance. You know that one?
I don't know that one.
Should I read it? It's translated from the German, so I think I can pronounce it all. The person who sent this in says, "This poem was given to me by Christian Jaworski, my first love, 5 years after we had broken up." And I won't read all the rest of that, but you can buy the book. About 12 lines here. Entrance. Whoever you are, in the evening, step out of your room where you know everything. Yours is the last house before the far off. Whoever you are. With your eyes, which in their weariness barely free themselves from the worn-out threshold, you lift very slowly one black tree and place it against the sky, slender, alone. And you have made the world, and it is huge, and like a word which grows ripe in silence. And as your will seizes on its meaning, tenderly your eyes let it go. Yes.
Is there a William Stafford poem there?
Let's see. Yes. There's one short William Stafford poem. So I'll read this. Maybe this will be our last one because it's just about time to head for Vespers. Person who sent this in, Lisa, someone from Nashville, Tennessee, writes, "I have a thin, jagged scar on my cheek, which I got while shaving at the age of 2, trying to emulate my father. I have 4 brothers. None of them ever tried it." And this poem is entitled Scars. "They tell how it was, and how time came along, and how it happened again and again. They tell the slant life takes when it turns and slashes your face as a friend. Any wound is real. In church, a woman lets the sun find her cheek, and we see the lesson. There are years in that book. There are sorrows a choir can't reach when they sing. Rows of children lift their faces of promise, places where the scars will be." There's the summer theme, promises. Kind of a different twist on it. The fact that those scars reveal old worlds about what we have endured. Well, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the sounds of the poetry. And books like this. Some various years in my life I've had these books where there's one poem a day for every day of the year. And it becomes a good discipline to, you know, read that poem a day picked out by somebody else. And of course you won't love every poem in it, but you'll discover some poems that are brand new. And now people like Harrison Keeler have the Writer's Almanac, where there's a new poem every day online to read. And it's a wonderful discipline because if